Hey there, Agents of Chaos. Surprise! This episode is here to hit you for an extra 2d6 sneak attack of audio shenanigans. I'm Shane, and I'm going to start with a confession. I'm getting on my knees, and I am begging Sans Luminous for absolution because I've been harboring a dark secret. I have not watched Buffy in its entirety. No, wait just a second before you delete this episode and before you block us from our feed. I know that's tempting, but I promise I'm going somewhere with this, and it ends in a present for you. You see, when my roommate at the time tried to get me to watch Buffy from the beginning, he warned me, you kinda have to just get through the first season. I did not. It's not a good season. It's just, oof, it's hard. And sadly, I think that the first season of a lot of shows can be very different in tone or motif. It takes some time to really find your voice, and I don't think that our show is any different. Now, I do love our early episodes, but I am also very much my own worst critic, overanalyzing every moment. So I promise you that our reception of our earliest episodes has been phenomenal, and my insecurities are largely unwarranted, but they are absolutely, undeniably not as polished as our later stuff. They're not as professionally done as our later stuff. And I want to give new listeners a guide of, you know, where to jump in, where the best spots are. That way, you can go back and listen to all that audio if you want to. And in fact, please do. I would love it forever if you did. But if you just want to jump in on the newest stuff, I want to make sure you're all caught up. So please go back and listen to all of them at your leisure, or maybe just the first half of season two. So here's what we're going to do. In this minisode, I'm going to give you an out-of-character recap. I know we've done this before, but I want to be sure new listeners have easy access to our adventure at whatever point you want to come in. So I'm starting at the beginning. This is about options and making the show as easy for you to get into as possible, so I'm going to start by recapping our first season, which ends with episode 12. You can listen to just that part, and then you can turn this episode off and go right back to episode 13, called Sugar Mama and Spice, and jump in at what we have retroactively called the beginning of our second season. If you want to go right to the newest content, though, keep listening, because I will then jump back into recap mode and recap the rest of the adventure up to the 26th episode, which is the season 2 mid-season finale. It's a good episode, though, and it ended with a major cliffhanger, so I hope that you will be excited and ready to jump into episode 27, the mid-season premiere. Okay, let's get into the recap, and I hope you enjoy.
Okay, let's try to get a narrator voice. Alright, does this sound like a narrator to you? I'm doing a little bit of, like, the Gloomhaven voice. Got kind of a slur going on, and it's really throwing off my mic. So we're gonna give it a try and see how it goes. The world of Ashua is broken. Nation empires have battled for over a millennium. Battles started as typical warfare, but soon the nation's appetite for power led to increasing escalation. Magic war machines became standard practice, but when this wasn't enough, the nation's leaders summoned elementals, demons, fae, and all manner of unusual creatures from beyond the material plane. When this predictably increased the wanton destruction, the gods themselves felt the need to get directly involved. But the ambition of the humanoids of Azuak could not be conquered by faith or divine might. When the continued machinations of mortals resulted in the death of a god, the others chose to seal off the material plane and leave the people of Azua to a fate they had crafted for themselves. This should have been where our story ends, but greed and ambition have no limit. And the surviving nations continued the war. The four remaining countries, Carib, Thiet, Malaris, and Fafsa, the Federated Alliance of the Free States of Azua. They each created their own massive monsters, behemoths capable of leveling cities with their immense power. They were known as Primal Titans. Named for the methods of their creation, they are embodiments of primal drives existing in all sentient life, of kinship, of dread, of industry, and of growth. Each of these titans eventually fell, but when the last two clashed, their battle demolished the nation of Thiet and broke the very sky. The sky now is left a permanent red, adorned by cracks. The sun has never again risen, so this has become known as the Last Dawn. Our adventure starts 17 years to the day after the Last Dawn on the border of Malaris and Fafsa, where we enter the nomadic community called The Community. The community is led by Manuela, or Ella for short, and a council of other elders. Like most of Azua, the community lacks adults of a fighting age, with elderly veterans who managed to flee or otherwise survive the war, and children who did not reach fighting age before the bloodshed ground to a halt. Their pride and joy is the young Silas Cantor, who serves as the mouthpiece and chosen champion of the community. According to the elders, Silas's mother must have been a frontline soldier and a badass lady who did not let a little thing like pregnancy stop her. They claim they found Silas as they fled the Last Dawn, no more than a day old, having miraculously survived unscathed when so many other lives were lost. They took this to be an omen, a sign that he had a great destiny before him. The major nations had expended most of their resources, but that does not mean that the danger had abated. No longer in open war, the nations still scheme to gain power over one another, and the Fafsin army sends their enrollers to explore the wastelands, to reclaim assets, and forcibly enlist into their army anyone who resists their authority. Wild creatures also roam the wastes, mutated and enhanced by the effects of the Last Dawn. Finally, the world is full of Nil, creatures that resemble people but lack any remaining humanity, roving the landscape in packs and devouring anyone foolish enough to come near. Fortunately for the community, some people are better suited for the harshness of Azua than others, and two such folks happened across them. Rufus was a wanderer, a giant of a man. He grew up in a strict church. He became disenfranchised with organized religion, and having seen his parents enlisted and killed, he became a conscientious objector to the war, running away and touring the wastelands, surviving on whatever he could find or hunt. Randall, however, was a little bit younger, and not yet a fighting age when the Last Dawn occurred. His parents, citizens of the far-off land of Thiet, sensed the country's impending doom and sent him far across the ocean in an escape pod. He survived in the wilds by relying on his training in the ways of magic, and on a spellbook left to him by his parents, which contained secret knowledge magically encrypted to defend against scrying eyes. Rufus and Randall were greeted by the community as guests, and given enough supplies for one day, with an offer to stay if they wished to pitch in and become permanent members of the community. They enjoyed a meager dinner made from the finest foods the community could find or produce, which was not much. Still, the community came together, sharing their stories and experiences. There they met Silas formally. The night ended amicably, with shared stories and mostly full bellies. The next day, Randall, Rufus, and Silas went on patrol with Yara, the community's 16-year-old blacksmith and leader of the scouts. A brief scuffle occurred with wild cockroaches, mutated to be large and dangerous. But this was nothing compared to the threat that arrived later in the evening. The scouts alerted the party to a group of three travelers with strange mounts, and armed visitors are rarely as respectful as Rufus and Randall had been. It fell on the community's champion to turn the potential invaders away if they would not follow the community's rules. But behind the closed tent flaps, Silas's attitude was different.
I don't know how to fight! You both survived out of the wild! You're both strong! Please help us!
The trio set out with Yara to face these newcomers. Though Silas attempted to talk it out, Rufus and Randall identified the visitors as Fafsin enrollers. The enrollers had metal weapons grafted to their bodies, and axe-beak mounts, large rideable birds with a beak akin to an axe blade, which had been subjected to mechanical augmentation as well. Rufus flew into combat, dicing enemy enrollers foolish enough to get close. Ultimately, the enrollers were defeated, and the group claimed their mounts, which they would come to call clockstridges. They also recovered a Fafsa bit, a communication device used by the Fafsin military, as well as a series of discs that seemed to go with it. Returning to the main community, our heroes met with Ella and Hank, an elder with a penchant for technology. The strange discs turned out to contain maps to various mines and other facilities formerly owned by the nation of Fafsa, and the enrollers seemed to be following these maps in an attempt to regain their former Fafsin assets. The community realized their location had been compromised, and they would have to find a new place to settle. They reasoned a Fafsin facility could provide shelter and protection as long as it was fully abandoned, and they decided to send Randall, Rufus, and Silas to scout out a nearby former Fafsin mine. When the trio arrived at the indicated location, they found a large bunker built into the side of the mountain and semi-camouflaged among the terrain. The door required a password, but Randall guessed it easily. Fafsa. Realizing that the previous occupants weren't particularly creative, the group entered to find the mine in active use. A battle quickly ensued as Rufus charged the Fafsin miners. Silas was peppered full of arrows and nearly lost his life, but Randall stayed behind to save him by feeding him mystery goop he found. The medicine turned out to be unpasteurized mutant cockroach milk, and it surprisingly had the desired effect, allowing Silas to return from unconsciousness. Meanwhile, one of the miners tried to flee and call reinforcements. Rufus charged further into the facility in pursuit. He made it through the garage that served as the entryway and charged up into a communal living space before cutting down the last of their enemies and preventing reinforcements from being called. The trio regrouped. There had been a dozen clockstriches in the garage, implying a few enemies were actively working in the mine somewhere deeper in the facility. Silas, not particularly wanting to risk further stabbing, set up a quick makeup station. Grabbing armor and prosthetic pieces from their fallen foes, he became Marjorie, one of the Fafsin miners. Marjorie then led another group of the fascist Fafsin army miners into an ambush, allowing Rufus and Randall to make quick work of them. Exploring the facility gave the group reasonable confidence that the remaining Fafsons would be in the deepest part of the mine. They enjoyed the ride in a minecart just a little too much for the severity of the situation, but ultimately found the remaining fascists, including a whip-wielding captain and a beefy brawler serving as her number two. Rufus jumped into the fray and ruthlessly pressed the military operatives. Randall suffered an attack by the captain, who dragged him out of the minecart towards her cohort. But Randall used Thunderwave as he was pulled through the air, the force of which rendered the brawler as not much more than splatter in two boots. The captain fought back against Rufus, but she met her end when Silas skewered her from behind, ending the fight, but leaving him shaken. Having defeated the Fafsons, the team returned to fetch the community, with a dozen clockstriches in tow. Hank helped them send a forged message from the enemy commander, telling the Fafson army that the facility had been destroyed and overrun by wild animals. It would be best to write it off. Amidst excited chatter, the community moved into its new home. Silas, however, was not as excited as the rest. He confided in Manuela, his adopted grandma, that he had reservations now that he had ended a person's life. She comforted him, but reminded him of his duty as the community's champion. Silas put on a brave face. Meanwhile, Rufus ate a potentially magical rock, drawing a few sideways glances. And Randall worked with Hank to further investigate the Fafson technology literally littered around their new home. The next morning, after remembering to change the password for the door, Rufus, Randall, and Silas embarked on their next mission, disposing of their fallen enemies without alerting the Fafson army. In Fafsa, meanwhile, a Githzerai Sarai soldier, Kitana Volare, was getting her newest orders. In service to Saint Cuthbert, the god of order, Kitana secretly seethed with rage for Fafsa and everything their empire included. She would take them down from within, so she had blown smoke up the right asses to rise in the ranks of the Fafsan army. Like many others, her new assignment was to lead a team into the borderlands to recover assets and forcibly enlist those who resist. As Silas, Randall, and Rufus distanced themselves and their morose cargo from the community's new home, they encountered a small building with a group of Nil surrounding it. The Nil looked like dehydrated bodies shambling around the wastes. Silas tried to lead the Nil away from the party, before he could, Rufus charged into battle. Utilizing their new mounts, the group was able to outpace the mob and engage them a few at a time. The Nil possessed the frightening ability to survive what should be lethal blows, snapping bones back into place and shambling on, but they were ultimately defeated. After the fight, Randall and Silas explored the nearby building, where they discovered evidence of humanoid use, despite the building having suffered major damage over the years. Though all the supplies were rotten, Randall was able to come to a terrifying conclusion. The Nil did not simply resemble people. They were people who had somehow turned into these creatures. The group they had just dispatched may have once been the people who inhabited this shelter. With Silas providing prestidigitated bubbles of lavender-scented air to help with the smell, they decided to take their bodies of the Nil as well, disposing of their morbid collection all at once and attempting to camouflage the Fafson bodies from any who might come across them. Returning to their new home, the group met with Hank and Manuela. Together, they unlocked a new feature in their Fafsa bit, a personal assistant. They decided to customize theirs as a corgi wearing boxing shorts and gloves named Georgie. Rufus also met with Yara, who gave him a new sword she had made him. The group was quickly given another mission. They needed to find valuable palm seeds so that the community could create a substantial food supply. They utilized a search function in the Fafsha bit and located a granary known to have the seeds just a few days' ride away. So the trio set off on their next fateful adventure. They needed to find valuable palm seeds so the community could create a sustainable food supply. They utilized a search function in the Fafsa bit, and located a granary known to have the seeds just a few days' ride away. So the trio set off on their next fateful adventure. En route to the granary, they encountered a nest of centipedes with metallic carapaces. Through gutsy use of Thunderwave and Firebolt spells, the trio prevailed. They realized, however, that the metal had been fused to the bugs as a result of the Last Dawn, highlighting just how devastating the disaster was, as it had ramifications all the way over here, across the great ocean from the epicenter of the event. On the morning of their expected arrival, Silas and Rufus awoke to find Randall was missing. He left a note sealed by a magic timer, giving him enough of a head start to escape unfollowed by his comrades. The note explained that he had unlocked new secrets from the spellbook his parents left him. He summoned a familiar for the first time and had been presented with some kind of new information, deciding it was best to go off alone to continue his research. His two companions searched for some time, but ultimately, they had to give up and let their friend go. Nearing their objective, Silas and Rufus began to find humanoid corpses along the trail, suspiciously dried out and surrounded by spiky little balls of plant matter. They approached nervously to find a plant monster guarding the granary. It attacked them as they drew near. It launched hundreds of seed pods into the air as they fought, and pressed Rufus into melee combat. Rufus realized it had a weakness to fire, but he was struck by the seed pods and felt them draining his life force. Swinging his sword in one hand and a lit torch in the other, he angered the creature and drew it away from the facility's entrance, an area covered in a protective mesh to defend against its guardian's attacks. He shouted instructions to Silas as he disappeared down the hill, drawing the guardian with him. Silas tried to follow, but he almost died in pursuit. Ultimately, he and his Clockstridge champion barely made it to the shelter in the granary's entryway. With a shout and a violent outburst against a nearby wall, Silas was alone. He wouldn't be alone for long, however. A group of Fafsin enrollers arrived while he was recovering, immediately putting Silas on the defensive. Their leader introduced herself as Kitana Volaire, but she was far from the meek persona she had used with her superior officers. In fact, one of her subordinates, a bugbear named Travis, was fed up with her firm commitment to regimented strictness, meaning that he was not allowed to murder indiscriminately. Travis had been regularly punished for not following commands during their travels, and an argument over what to do with Silas escalated to full-blown mutiny, resulting in an unexpected alliance. Kitana and Silas dispatched her former unit, leaving only a single survivor. Though Kitana insisted on removing his tongue to ensure he would not talk, and only then did she release him back into the wasteland alone. Whew, okay, that voice. One, I've been playing way too much Gloomhaven. I'm sorry for my bad voice. It started kind of Scottish like the Gloomhaven narrator, but then it kind of like got Britishy, and I was trying real hard not to like accidentally go into Eastern European. I swear I do more than one voice, but I don't do them well. None of them. In any case, that brings us to the end of our first season. Silas went on a few adventures. He lost his comrades, both of them. That's 100% failure rate. Yay. If you are ready to jump in there
you may head over to episode 13, Sugar Mama and Spice. That is the start of our season 2, and it starts with Kitana and Silas becoming an unlikely duo as they have to go through a door. It's really that simple. In D&D, doors are enemies. I don't know why that's a thing, but like every door, it has a password or a puzzle. It's the worst. I want to draw your attention to one of our favorite holidays, which we celebrated in season 2, Three Kings Day. Irmán loves Three Kings Day and loves sharing it with us silly Americans who were born here and just aren't as familiar with it. He usually brings the D&D group together for a special holiday game filled with meta theatrics, real life cake, and plenty of D&D nonsense. That's why, despite not actually having introduced Valen as a character yet, we released our Three Kings Day episode anyway to share our love of the holiday with you. Yeah, I remember having to write the spoiler warning because oopsies. The Three Kings adventure was set during a dream sequence happening between episodes 15 and 16, and it is semi-canonical. We got some loot, we keep in the loot, but otherwise it's about as canonical as a Dragon Ball Z movie. Like, yeah, it's there, it's technically part of stuff, but it's kind of not. In any case, I left it in the recap where it would be chronologically, but the important thing to remember for the main story is just we got to keep our neat stuff. It is a fun episode, and I hope you will check it out. I also will take the second to draw your attention to our second Paralogue episode, which came out after I wrote the script for this recap, and presented a significant problem because it takes place directly after the Three Kings Day paralogue. Literally, the morning after is when it takes place. However, I have omitted it from this recap because it is from the perspective of our rat cups, which, well, if you haven't listened to us yet, that's a weird concept that you're just going to have to get used to. But we did a Toy Story parody. That was our second Paralogue episode. And if you look back into the feed, it came out just before Ventus Haven released, I believe. So check our feed if you'd like to go back and listen to that one. It was pretty funny. And because it was an April Fool's joke, well, I wrote the game and I gave it over to Brandon and made him run it on his own. Honestly, one of our better episodes. So there you are. If you want to jump in on season 2, go ahead and start with episode 13, Sugar Mama and Spice, which starts moments after the ending of the last season. Silas and Kitana have dispatched her mutinous crew and are ready to enter the granary. I think it's a great place to jump in, but if you want to get right to the newest content, I've got you. Here's the recap for the first half of season 2.
New allies weren't able to enter the granary just yet, as they faced off with a puzzle to unlock the door. Professor Fleming, a flamingo-colored Arakocra, or bird person, guided them through a musically scientific puzzle, and when they found the solution, welcomed them to the granary. Inside, they found a thriving city hidden from Fafsin authorities. After a long journey, rest was finally in sight. Realizing neither of them had any remaining traveling companions and being accustomed to giving orders, Kitana decided to invest in Silas in the form of purchasing a magic sword for him. The Aurora Borealis Grande. A special, definitely one-of-a-kind sword covered in rhinestones and channeling elemental energy with each swing. Tucking away a crate of similar swords. The merchant also threw in an earpiece microphone, which when a high note is sung into it, changes the user's sword into a more lithe form, allowing Silas to wield the normally heavy blade with finesse. He also began his training in the College of Valor, while Kitana immediately set herself to work archiving the granary's resources in a more organized manner. They also bought souvenir rat cups, rats that can transform into chalices, but remain exactly as furry. But Kitana and Silas were not the only recent visitors to the granary. Valen Silverwind was a tiefling on a mission. Taking up the duties of his grandmother before him, Valen was in service to the Raven Queen, a goddess who had been separated from the material plane along with the other divine entities. Valen had come from the islands of Carib to seek aid in his mysterious quest. He used his time in the granary to trade information. He met the same merchant that sold Silas and Kitana the Ariana Borealis Grande, catching her throwing bones to divine hidden knowledge. She and Valen took turns trading questions and answers. She revealed that Silas did indeed carry an important destiny, if not on his own, because of the allies he would foster. Set on recruiting Silas and Kitana, Valen ambushed the unlikely duo as they were ready to leave, precious seeds in hand. Things immediately got awkward, so Valen decided to retake his entrance. This seemed reasonable to Kitana and Silas, so they let Valen reintroduce himself. This time they found him to be quite charming. They decided to go ahead to the community, with Valen following not long behind, so he could gather supplies at the granary first. Returning home, Silas introduced various members of the community to Kitana, who was very impressed with the community's reliance on safety procedures which kept things orderly. Valen arrived not long after, play fighting with Silas for the amusement of the community's children. He brought enough food and treats to throw a small feast. After a heartfelt conversation about his purported destiny with his grandmother, Silas spent a few days in awe of the progress the community had made setting up a stable living situation in the former Fafsin mine. He stopped only to ask Yara for a late-night meeting. Kitana also grew close with Yara. Knowing that Valen still had details of a quest to pitch them, Kitana expressed concern about taking Silas from the safety of the community. Valen similarly spoke with Manuela, wondering if the legend of Silas's birth had robbed him of a choice in his life path. Though still uneasy, the two new party members resolved themselves over dinner to prioritize protecting and nurturing Silas during their upcoming quest. With Hank's help, Valen gave his pitch. His grandmother had been in service to the Raven Queen before he took over her responsibilities. After one of their own died during the war, the deities of Azua decided to seal off the material plane. Wanting to return to Azua, the Raven Queen tasked Valen with utilizing the power of the Islands of Carib, a power based in kinship and mindful unity of the Carib people, to fuel a magical cannon capable of blasting a hole in the barrier between planes. To do this, he would have to accrue support in Carib and be accepted as their new Kay Kasike, the Pirate King. Though she quickly claimed it as part of her new inquisition, Kitana did not take much convincing to join the mission, since it would make her connection to St. Cuthbert more direct. Silas had made his position clear while talking with Manuela. If he was needed, he'd go. That's what heroes do. And this is where our story gets odd. In a holiday episode with a triumphant god, three wizard kings into Azua came forth and brought with a dream sequence for the heroes, of course. The trio faced challenges to help out the spirits, and a Fafsin playhouse held the task that was nearest. They stood face to face with a legend, a queen. It was Clockwork Helen Mirren, star of stage and screen. Silas danced with her measure by measure, bowed when they were done, and said, "'Twas my pleasure." He collected Miss Mirren, now a figurine, as the trio continued along in their dream. They flew over islands of green and of blue, and arrived in Carib, a place Valen knew.
They faced off with hooligans getting high on the shore by beating on dummies, so there would be no gore. Through might and through trickery, Valen won the damage race, and he claimed their bong so he could blow smoke in their face. Now, don't do drugs is a lesson that rocks, but this let Valen share buff spells within a hotbox. So the trio again took to the skies and landed at a church with widened eyes. Kitana knew this service and what to do, and leapt into the mosh pit where some punches she threw. The violent rituals left poor Silas bloodied, but Kitana triumphed, avenging her buddy. She got for her troubles the vessel used for donations, but it could hold much more money than her expectations. They returned to the Three Kings with plenty of clues to unlock their spellbooks and end the gods' blues. Puzzles took the party too long to solve. Both meta and cryptic, they were quite involved. And lo, the dream ended. The trio awoke, but they still had their treasures in case Valen wanted a toke.
Okay, back to gruff narrator voice. Vaguely renaissance-y. The next morning, the trio of heroes set out from the community. Hank had identified a potential upgrade for the Fafsabit located in an old naval facility near Valen's ship, so the group decided to take a small detour. The first leg of their journey proved contentious, with Valen and Kitana frequently butting heads. It was Silas, however, who argued that they shouldn't use lethal force against local wildlife, when a giant moth passed the trio during their journey. Ultimately, a conflict with one of these creatures was unavoidable, and after a tense skirmish, Valen cut the moth down. Before long, however, our heroes made it to the defunct Fafsin naval base. The door was locked, requiring the group to pair images with related schools of magic by casting cantrips or spells into the device itself. A mistake saw Valen teleported directly up several stories, with a predictable, immediate result. After a few more attempts and a few safety precautions, Valen eventually manipulated arcane energy skillfully enough to fool the locking mechanism and unlock the door. The interior of the facility was dark and drab. While exploring cautiously, the group was attacked by a small group of Nil, but these functioned differently than the Nil Silas had previously fought. They were capable of acting when dismembered, and one severed arm clawed at Kitana's face, particularly ferociously. The heroes ultimately triumphed, defeating the Nil and locating the upgrade to their Fafsabits. This upgrade gave them the power to summon a giant spectral hand, which could aid them in battle with a variety of offensive and defensive functions. The group looted some tools and enjoyed the oceanside view before moving on. Continuing onward, the party encountered a small family-owned business. Himbo and Sons Wood Company. Valen bought some high-quality wood to bring back to Carib while deflecting Silas's questions about himbos. Lumber in tow, they rendezvoused with his crew, the Silver Talons. They were greeted by the ship's shaman, Mevi, a gruff, deep-voiced woman who immediately butted heads with Kitana. Valen talked them down, and after Mevi taught them the appropriate greetings to be used before boarding the ship.
"Sins, Your Honor."
They observed her customs and boarded the Raven's Call. Kitana and Silas adapted to a life at sea with varying degrees of success. They met the rest of the crew, including Prism, a spider who can take the form of the ship's altar, and Xander, a non-binary Arakocra with bright, colorful plumage who serves as Valen's first mate. Not long into their journey, a sudden swell in the waves formed itself into the image of a handsome red-finned triton, Tibercio, a long-time rival of Valen's. With two companions at his side, one an octopus triton and the other a capybara beastman, he revealed that Valen wasn't the only one trying to unite Carib and become the next K-Cacique. Having quested to gather allies of his own, Tibercio cried with glee that he was a step ahead, and the visage crashed down over the Raven's Call. Kitana bolstered the crew, but Silas quickly found himself flailing upside down in the rigging. Valen used the ship's emergency supply of spell scrolls to help Mevi and Xander guide the ship to safety, and they continued their journey. The group arrived at Arjan, the island where Valen grew up. Kitana and Silas were immediately in awe. A curtain of vines magically animated and opened itself to allow them entry, revealing a verdant island, vibrant with life and a large encampment with hundreds of residents. Sneaking up from behind, Valen was attacked by an elderly woman with a knife. She wrestled him to the ground, but when she went for the kill, her blade turned away. Valen hugged her and introduced her as his grandmother, Val. She explained that she was testing him. People from Carib are magically incapable of killing one another, and she wanted to ensure Valen still considered himself part of the family. Silas was suitably horrified, but offered her a gift of moonshine Yara had made. Kitana approved of her parenting style. No notes. They had a grand dinner and discussed their plans to unite Carib, resulting in Silas resolving to never again eat cute animals. Though they were enjoying the sights of the island, Silas was intrigued by the magic that prevents the people of Carib from killing each other. He brainstormed with Kitana about finding a way to scale it up to all of Azua. This led to a discussion about Kitana's faith, and she taught Silas about vibing. Just the general practice of finding the right spiritual vibrations. The party then traveled with Grandma Val to a nearby city to meet Valen's uncle Hippolyto, and to further discuss their upcoming plans. Although Valen had a few islands ready to support his bid for Kay Kasike, Tibercio had already formed some support as well, and an upcoming parade would be crucial to the quest. Each island was set to send a float for the parade, which would be judged by the leaders of the islands. The chosen representative of the winning island would gain the support of Carib and become the next Kay Kasike. Unfortunately, there were two problems hindering Arjan's chances. First, their float had been recently sabotaged. Reconstruction was underway, but the damage had been done. Second, a series of strange deaths had drawn attention. Officials were largely writing it off as a coincidence because the people of Carib cannot kill each other. But the party immediately suspected foul play. There were some pretty shady circumstances, such as the victims having all been strangled by rope. So it seemed pretty obvious to our heroes that these were not mere accidents. The group investigated the home of the latest victim, a former member of Grandma Val's crew. She had been in possession of the replica of the Sigil of Arjan, a disc marking the bearer as the leader, and meant to be given to Arjan's choice for Kay Kasike, while also serving as a necessary focus to utilize the laser cannon that can puncture the barrier between planes. Kitana identified the means of ingress, while Silas put together clues in the bedroom where a fight had occurred. The trail grew cold, so after a quick pineapple skewer for lunch, the party decided to secretly monitor the float construction. Silas and Valen infiltrated the reconstruction as Charlie and Valix? Master Crimpers, and discovered a love for the art of crimping in the process. Kitana, meanwhile, proselytized within earshot. Sure enough, the perpetrator struck, but seemed to be invisible. The heroes leapt into action, some literally, as Silas cast fairy fire and flung himself off the ship, grabbing the flying invisible assailant. The tides turned when the vandal introduced a hydraulically powered repeating dagger to Silas's intestines. That was an unwelcome surprise. However, that was not as bad as the rope he was carrying, which came to life and attempted to strangle the hero in training.
Thanks to his efforts, however, Kitana and Valen were able to handle the situation quickly, even being able to take their foe alive. The assassin seemed terrified, however, and as soon as they began to interrogate him, the rope returned to life and began to strangle its former partner. Valen cut the rope in half, but was moments too late, making the prisoner another dead end. Valen insisted on a quick garbage can funeral and eulogized the former foe. But afterwards, he brightened the mood by teaching Silas and Kitana about cupcakes, a luxury neither had experienced before. The group met again with Grandma Val. Despite Silas's bouncing around the room in the midst of his first sugar rush, this time she was accompanied by the survivors of her crew, each presenting a replica of Arjan's disc. Val had used ritual magic to ensure they could not know who had the real disc, and now with the replicas gathered, she had the spell reversed, destroying the replicas and presenting Valen with the true sigil of Arjan. She tasked the party with recovering the discs of the nearby allied islands while the citizens of Arjan focused on rebuilding the float. And if Tiburcio's float happened to get vandalized along the way, what a sad, tragic turn of events that would be. Valen decided to update the party's wardrobe before leaving, so after a brief fashion montage, they were on their way. Passing the curtain of vines, however, they discovered a person in a large diving suit who seemed to be tangled up. They took a moment to free him, and he introduced himself as Lucien L. Lawton, a creator of designer brand armors. Hearing the party's quest, however, he verbally sparred with Valen, accusing the latter of being just another upstart trying to gain power. Things eventually calmed down, however, as they found they had a mutual enemy in Tiburcio. Lucien agreed to a tentative alliance and set up a workshop in the cargo hold. While at sea, the party got closer to each other and to the crew by playing cards and doing other activities. Everyone shared in the daily duties, and Kitana and Silas began to get their sea legs. But soon a glowing arcane symbol began to follow the ship. Realizing this was a summoning circle, Kitana warned the party. Lucien jumped into the water to engage the threat, causing Xander to follow out of distrust. Under the cloak of the water, Lucien had undergone some kind of transformation, but they didn't have time to discuss it. A giant, twin-headed shark appeared. Valen and Kitana also jumped in, and together the group pummeled it into submission. The crew began to regroup, but Valen and Lucien dove deep under the water and found an inky substance used to create the summoning circle. Lucien was wary, but Valen reached out to examine it further, and the moment he touched it, he blacked out. And that's where our story is now. You're all caught up. You're ready to jump in with the second half of season two. I am so excited because if you're listening to this, it means I got this out in time that this is a dual release, baby. I really hope you're having as good a time listening as we are while we play. If we're putting a smile on a few faces, I feel like we've done our podcast right. So that's it. You're up to date. But we would still love to hear from you. We link our Discord in the show notes in every episode, so come give me an excuse to take more pictures. I am going to be happy to post every picture of Sirius I can. He's been sitting in my little castle with me as I record this, taking up the whole thing, because that is his special talent. If you're not a Discord kid, though, or if you're ancient like me and you think that a TikTok is a brand of breath mint, we'd love for you to reach out to us by email at legendofnat1@gmail.com. Send in treasure ideas, tell us about your own adventures, nitpick my jokes for continuity errors, there are plenty there. We love all of it. We're also on YouTube now as Legend of Nat 1, so that's nice and easy to remember. Please give us a subscribe if you can. Every episode is up with some lovely artwork by Pavel. But if you're listening to this, you already know where to find us. please consider giving us a 5-star review on whatever podcast app you're using. It does feel a little rude to ask, like I feel like we're begging, but please, get those algorithms to show us some love. Every little bit counts, and I'll volunteer Iman to come clean your kitchen in nothing but an apron. This is not legally binding. You must wrangle Iman on your own. If you do want to go above and beyond, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nat1pod. I want to give a quick shout-out and a huge thank you to Psyker, by the way, who backs us over there. There aren't a lot of rewards on our Patreon yet. In the meantime, it's just because you love us. But we are fleshing it out and trying to bring to you some little extra bits of bonus content and other rewards. We really want to give back to anyone who believes in us. Remember, for just pennies a day, you could support a podcast. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the second half of Season 2. In the arms of an angel, far away from here. I don't know the words, something, something, and you'll find some comfort here. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's how it goes. No need for a second take.
Remember, if you like our podcast and enjoy our content, make sure to check us out on Discord.
There's a link in our show notes.
The Legend of Nat 1 theme is by David Yardley. You can find more of his work at davidyardleymusic.com. That's Yardley spelled Yardley.
Logo by Ben Thwaite.
You can follow us on our socials, The Legend of Nat 1 on Facebook and Nat 1 Pod on Instagram and Twitter.
That is Nat, the number one, Pod.
And if you really like our content, you can throw us a dollar on Patreon, Nat 1 Pod.
Email us at legendofnat1@gmail.com to give us feedback, suggestions, or criticisms that will haunt us for the rest of our days.
The majority of our music is by Kevin MacLeod, and the license is provided by incompetech.filmmusic.io.
Valen decided he needed his own theme music. You can find Pirates of the Quarantine by Alexander Nakarada, and the license is provided by filmmusic.io.
I love that. I love that. That is loved by me.
It seems a bit biased about your love.
Our amazing editing is done by the incomparable Brandon Lee,
also known affectionately as Pooh Bear,
with assistance by Shane Cherry.
Hey, that's me.
And if you didn't like our content, again, we are The Adventure Zone.
That's some gay history right there, because that is a staple drag queen joke.
Yes, it is.
Beautiful.
They also bought souvenir rat cups. Rats that can transform into chalices, but remain exactly as furry.
Yikes. I can't believe we used rat cups.